WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The hospital emergency room used to be just that. A single room, usually staffed by the least experienced physicians, interns in their first year of training, and doctors from different branches of medicine who happened to be on call. That began to change in the 1970s to the point where today emergency medicine has become the newest specialty in the medical field. Today, doctors specializing in emergency medicine staff what have become large centers open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the year. Interestingly, the man who literally wrote the book on emergency medicine, the late Dr. John Marks, lived and worked in Charlotte. And joining us now to share the history of this burgeoning field are three experts. Experts because they are working every day in the emergency room. Dr. Angela Fasaro. Angela Fasaro is an emergency medicine physician and past speaker of the Council of the Emergency Medicine Residents Association, and she is a staff physician in Gaston Memorial Hospital's Emergency Department. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you here. Dr. Don Stater is senior emergency medicine resident at Carolinas Medical Center and immediate past president of the Emergency Medicine Residents Association. That's a lot of words. Hard to say. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike, and you can abbreviate it EMRA.
EMRA. That may be even more difficult. They are both with us, obviously, in our Spirit Square studio, and Dr. John Moorhead joins us by phone from Portland, Oregon. He is the current president of the American Board of Emergency Medicine and former president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. Thank you for joining us as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. Why the two different organizations? And maybe there are more than two. I don't know. But why so many organizations to handle one specialty? Who wants to take that? Go ahead.
There's an actual alphabet soup of emergency medicine organizations. The largest one and the one that really leads the specialty is ASEP, the American College of Emergency Physicians. ABEM, which Dr. Moorhead is the president of, actually does all the certification, certifies you as a board-certified emergency physicians. EMRA is really unique in the whole house of medicine in that the residents have their own organization which they run and which they use to kind of be the spokespeople of the future of the field. And that exists in no other residency, no other specialty in the House of Medicine. Hmm. And in fact, you know, the kids, the emergency medicine residents, have the second largest organization in the House of Emergency Medicine. So it's really a unique circumstance.
Did you just call yourself a kid?
I did. And I look young enough that my patients often do too.
Well, yes, I was.
You're aging gracefully.
Yes, neither of you look old enough to be doctors. That means I'm really old. What was it, doctors who first decided that emergency medicine should be a specialty all its own?
I think that actually the patients and the public probably demanded something that doctors then responded to, and that caused the creation of emergency medicine. I think that there was a lot of things that were changing in the 1960s and 70s that there was a gap, and patients needed care at times when it wasn't at that, you know, at that time available, and it led to there being the need for our specialty. So although we quote-unquote created it, I think it was in response to a demand from the patients themselves.
And we'll talk about what goes into being qualified to be an emergency room specialist. But explain to me, Dr. Moorhead, why it was determined that GPs, general practitioners, could not operate efficiently or well in the emergency room, why a heart surgeon couldn't be pressed into action or a gastroenterologist be pressed into action to serve a weekend shift in the emergency room. What was wrong with that? Everybody has a medical education.
Well, everyone has a medical education that allows them to practice medicine, and each of the state boards assures that physicians are qualified to practice generally in medicine, but physicians specialize both in their training and that develop through experience specific focus in a specific focused area, a specialty, a subspecialty, a niche area within medicine, and they have both special training and ongoing expertise in that area. So as the early emergency departments formed and a variety of physicians with a variety of backgrounds would bring that specific background to the emergency department. They would be very comfortable if a patient happened to present that day with their area of expertise. But if they presented with an area that was away, a different kind of a problem, a heart doctor would be in the emergency department and a patient would arrive who'd been in a car accident, that heart doctor would not be very familiar with the sort of standard techniques for treating those kinds of patients, or a pediatric patient or a stroke or those kinds of medical emergencies. And the kinds of patients we see often do have true life-threatening emergencies and require time-dependent care. And it became very obvious that we needed physicians with specific training to work in that environment, in that realm of patient population.
You know, as you were talking, it strikes me that you folks in the emergency room see anything and everything every single day. So you're seeing people who need heart treatments. You've seen people who have stomach ulcers. You're seeing people who have had a stroke, who've had a knife wound or a gunshot wound. I mean, you need to know everything about everything. I need to be able to respond to it quickly. So what kind of training prepares you for that?
Well, I guess I'm the one still going through training, so I'll go ahead and speak to that point. If I can just, you know, go back, it's interesting. Medical specialties, when you think about it, some of them are defined anatomically. An ENT deals with, you know, the neck up. And OB-GYN obviously deals with, you know, something much, much lower. Other specialties are defined by age. You have pediatricians. You have geriatricians, which deal with the extremes of age. Our specialty is really defined by two things. One is availability, and two is the urgency of treatment. So when you're going through your specialty, really what you're focusing on is what do you do? What are the next steps you have to do in the next hour, the next 2 hours to stabilize a patient so they do not die? And that goes all the way from a pediatric patient who might come in with sepsis, a blood infection in their bloodstream, to a person who's been shot close to the heart, to an old person who's fallen and is bleeding in the head. And you have to know the whole spectrum of disease and what to do in all those people, who to call, and how to stabilize them so that they don't end up having a bad outcome.
So given the fact that you have to know a little bit about a lot, and maybe a lot about a lot, I'm not sure how deep it has to be, but it's got to be wide, and it's got to be quick, and you got to make the right decision or the person could die in your care. What type of person does it take to do this job well?
I think a person who's resilient, someone who can learn to optimize their performance with very minimal resources and very little information, because oftentimes we're making decisions with without a full deck of cards, if you will. Mm-hmm. Someone who is not defeated or doesn't feel defeated with, say, something that doesn't go perfectly the first time, learning from that and applying that that skill now to the next patient that you see. Being able to connect immediately with people so that you can get the most information from them, so that, you know, in that 2 to 3 minutes sometimes that you have, you're getting almost 100% of what you need so that you can treat them, you know, as well as possible.
What attracted you? I want to hear from the three of you. What attracted each of you to this specialty of medicine? Because this comes with a lot of pressure, it seems to me. Dr. Fasara, let me start with you.
I like the diversity of my exposure in the emergency department when I was doing my rotations in medical school. I really liked that I felt humbled every day that I went to work early on. I could do things that made me feel like a hero, and I could do things that, again, were just humbling to me, and I learned every day. And so knowing that every day would be a challenge but one that would be exceptionally rewarding is really what attracted me to emergency medicine.
Dr. Stater.
There's really two things. One is, I think people who go into emergency care are novelty seekers. They want something new every day. They don't want to have the same experience twice. And every day is a different shift with different people. It's never like Cheers where everyone knows your name. the other thing that really drew me to it is really the charity care that emergency medicine provides. We never look at someone's ability to pay. You never wonder about, you know, those type of things. That's totally outside the spectrum. If they show up at your door, you're responsible for them. And you provide more care to the homeless and indigent populations, mm-hmm. provide more care to people who can't afford their care. So really that type of charity attracted me to the field. And I do think that, you know, emergency medicines carry that banner.
I'm going to ask Dr. Moorhead the same question. He's the president of the American Board of Emergency Physicians or Emergency Medicine. I get them wrong. And you've probably been at it the longest, although I can't see you, so you could be 15 years old. I don't know. But what attracted you to this, and what keeps you going in this field?
Well, Michael, I was began my practice after my residency 36 years ago, so I have been doing this a while. I was in one of the very earliest training programs that were set up to train doctors to work in emergency medicine. And I'd been attracted because I simply loved everything I did in medicine. I loved as you go through training at that time, you would do some training in pediatrics or internal medicine or surgery or a subspecialty area. And I loved everything. I enjoyed, the aspect of practice that was very attractive to me was the acute care. And we were often called adrenaline junkies at that point because it's a very, very fast-paced environment. You never know what's coming. You never know what kind of a problem a patient will present with. You've never met these people, but they're at one of the critical points in their life often. And to be able to interact and intercede for a patient and their family in that situation was a tremendous satisfying feeling where you really help somebody and make a difference in their lives. As it developed, I think the emergency department became kind of a laboratory about our whole health system, because not only are we set up to deal with acute patients and acute patient needs, but we, through the kinds of patients and their situations that they come to us for care, we get an idea about what is working in the health system. And patients come to us not only for that acute need, but when they can't find anyone else to care for them or they don't know where to go, they come to our doors and we're more than happy to treat them. And I think we still have that feeling in every emergency department in this country, and it's still a great feeling. We collaborate, and I think that's another feature of people who work in this specialty. We may treat somebody for the first 5 minutes or even the first 2 hours if they're in shock or they have an overwhelming infection, but we're totally dependent and work collaboratively with all the other specialties to provide that ongoing care for that acute problem. Until the patient successfully is resuscitated and then treated for that particular problem. So we work very, very closely with the other specialties and, in fact, depend on their availability to help us in managing the patients, often with well-set-up protocols as soon as patients arrive at the door.
Hmm. You've been at this the longest, Dr. Moorhead, and as you said, you were in one of the first groups of people to be trained specifically for this field. From your point of view, I kind of described the emergency room and how it was set up before the specialty emerged. How has it changed because of the influence of people like you?
Well, it's Angela was saying earlier, the motivation was a realization that patient care could be improved, not only when patients are presented to an emergency room, the first one being in Alexandria, Virginia, which was a little room in the basement of a hospital, to full-blown departments, which now in many hospitals are essentially the front door to the hospital. Most of the patients who get admitted come through the emergency department, receive some acute care at that point, and then are admitted to the hospital. Patients are now managed by teams of physicians and nurses and other ancillary personnel who are trained to provide that care, who do it in a very coordinated way, in a very efficient way. The emergency department is much, much busier for many reasons. As many as 130 million people come to the emergency department across the country looking for care. So we have better trained individuals, we have better communication, and we have care that actually extends right out into the community.
Let me stop you there because we have to take a break. We'll come back with more about emergency medicine, the youngest field of medicine currently in existence, in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Diamond Springs, offering bottled water, coffee, and filtration services to the home or office. More information about Diamond Springs at 1-800-715-2286. Reducing the high school dropout rate is a must, and now it's become the goal of several organizations in Charlotte, including the Arts and Science Council. They're launching a brand new program to serve at-risk students. It's called Studio 345. It's based on a program that's been in operation since the mid-70s in Pittsburgh. using arts and education and the community to empower students to help them succeed. And we'll find out all about that program and the master program, the one up in Pittsburgh, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Day in Ream show, last week's tragedy in Connecticut prompts new concerns about how to keep students safe at school, what parents, administrators, and safety experts think should be done to improve security.
Join the Diane Ream Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about emergency medicine, which is the youngest field of medicine, with Dr. John Moorhead, who joins us from Portland, Oregon. He's the president of the American Board of Emergency Medicine. Dr. Don Stater is the senior emergency medicine resident at Carolinas Medical Center. And Dr. Angela Fasaro is an emergency medicine physician at Gaston Memorial. The only exposure I've had to the emergency room, I think, has been on television. And I'm not just talking through these drama shows like Chicago Hope, but through these reality shows that ABC has been putting on over the summertime sometimes. One's called Boston Med. One took place in New York City, where they literally take you into the emergency room, and it looks frantic. Is it always frantic?
I don't think it's always frantic, and I think frantic is defined by your perspective. So to us, that seems like a very normal environment. We know the ins and outs of the processes, and you know, we've learned to perform within what seems like chaos, I think, from the outside. But I think to the outside observer who's probably never been there, or to who's seeing it for the first time, it does seem frantic because it's almost always high volume. Everything happens very quickly. Mm-hmm. There's almost a language that's spoken amongst the people who work there that we understand that probably from the outside, again, just seems foreign. So,
given the fact that you see so many people and you don't know them, you're not their physician on a regular basis, one would presume, although in some cases you are, are these people people, or are they medical conditions that need to be dealt with?
So I think that they are very much people. And I think that the fact that we do not know them and have to establish that relationship and care for them like they are our family, you know, even though we don't have that pre-existing relationship, really ennobles what we do. When you think about it, it's in some ways the purest form of caring for someone, having no relation with them, having no knowledge of what they've done, and frankly not caring what they are, if they're a good person or a bad person. Our job when people come to the emergency department is not to judge them. It's to care for them. And that's something that gives, I think, all of us who work in the field a great amount of fulfillment. People who you'll find that you care for people very, and I think a lot of emergency physicians, very quickly, especially if they've got something that's really going on with them. And oftentimes their family comes with them. And in a very quick amount of time, you can really get the lay of the land by how much this person means or how much their family means to them. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, there's a tremendous amount of intensity in emergency medicine. And a lot of that intensity is derived from the social interactions that take place within the walls.
And that intensity can be emotional intensity, both on the part of the patient and their family, and I would think, to a certain degree, the staff. I mean, you're dealing with people who are in all kinds of situations, some of which you're successful with, some of which you are not. How do you handle it?
Well, I'll take a jab at that one. Michael, we've had some examples of exactly what you're talking about recently with some tragic events around this country, one in my town here in Portland. And one of the aspects that we're most satisfied with is our care for patients extends out from the emergency department into a whole system called the Emergency Medical Services System, where paramedics work with law enforcement, whatever, to provide care out of hospital. That was also one of the demonstrated needs for the creation of our specialty. That care needed to be coordinated with what was happening in the emergency department. And we've seen that in instances of critical need, whether it's a natural disaster or a man-made incident, that the public expects that system to be operational. And I think all of us feel extremely proud of the response that the emergency medical systems have shown throughout the country in these situations. So that's a tremendously satisfying feeling to be proud and to see your colleagues working in a coordinated way to provide that acute care in a, quote, disaster situation. But it does take an emotional toll, and it was pretty evident watching the people involved in these separate events, mm-hmm. the kind of toll that it takes. So for somebody who's been doing this for a long time, that's one of the characteristics of folks as well, that you need to be able to deal with that emotion, deal with that child in a difficult situation, but then move on because there are other patients who require your need. And then we deal with some of our feelings and how things have gone outside of the emergency department with our colleagues in different ways, and whatever way works for people providing that care, but as part of a team.
I said in the opening, and I got these statistics from one of your organizations, that although many of us, if we're lucky, will not ever see an oncologist or a heart surgeon in our lives, most of us, and this actually struck me as being amazing, almost all of us at one time or another will end up in the ER. Really? All of us?
If you look at it, around 20% of the U.S. population comes to our doors as a patient every year. You know, that's 2 out of every 10 people. Those people, on average, bring another two people, family members, with them. So I think that in many cases, and thankfully, Mike, you are the exception rather than the rule.
I've been there with people, but I've never gone there myself.
Yeah. And and hopefully, you know, hopefully you will not go for many, many more years.
Okay.
But, you know, it's unpredictable, life is. You know, you could be absolutely fine and then have a tragic accident. Mm. You could be assaulted. You know, you could just feel bad and have a cough and end up with a pneumonia and can't get into your primary care doctor, you know, in the next week or so, or because it's Christmas holidays and you can't get in to see them. So people come to our doors for that.
Are you particularly busy on Christmas and New Year's and Thanksgiving and all the holidays that normal physicians close their doors on?
We are particularly busy, especially at times where you cannot get access to care in any other environment. So after banking hours, on weekends, mm-hmm. during holidays. And
how many of the visits that you see day to day are legitimate visits, people who have had an accident, fell off a ladder, had, you know, hurt their head, something like that, versus somebody coming to you with the sniffles? And they have a little tummy ache, and they don't feel well, and they want an antibiotic. How many of our legit, if that's the right word to use, and how many are not? How many you would prefer to have them go elsewhere?
Well, Michael, I think every person who arrives in our emergency department is there with a legitimate need, and it's been shown that about 88% of patients have acute needs which need to be addressed within 12 to 24 hours. So there's been some political statements made by folks. They think they can save our system a whole lot of money by redirecting people out of the emergency setting somewhere else. That has tended not to work very well. The vast majority of patients have acute needs that need to be tended to within 12 to 24 hours. And other patients arrive because, as Angela was saying earlier, they have nowhere else to get care. We want to work in a system where people work in a coordinated way, have access to primary care, and come to us for the primary reason that we're there. But as Don said earlier, we're very proud of the fact that we are there 24 hours a day. And if you have a need, and if it needs acute care, your problem, we will be there to take care of it. It will be taken care of just as well in Charlotte as it will in Portland, Oregon, or New York, or Los Angeles, because we've standardized the training, standardized our delivery system, have very well-trained people working in a coordinated system to provide that care.
You want to add to that, Dr.?
To our patients.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
We do need to work both with our specialists within the hospital to coordinate care, as well as physicians out of the hospital who are going to see patients after we've provided one little glimpse of their care, stabilized them, and made a determination that they're safe and can have their ongoing care provided in an outpatient setting. So we want to, and we do function in the best systems, as part of an overall coordinated healthcare delivery system.
You want to add to that, Dr. Stater?
I would love to. And Mike, I love the question because it illustrates something that a lot of policymakers and a lot of people in the general public have, is that this conception that there's a lot of people in the emergency department who don't need to be there, mm-hmm. and that they're wasting the government's money, they're wasting their own time, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I really challenge that notion. I'd say that everyone being there has a legitimate reason to be there. And here's the reason why, is one of the founders of emergency medicine, Jim Mills, and this was all the way back in 1961, the first emergency medicine practice, you know, and he said words which are almost prophetic and still ring true today. And he said, basically, so much is made about what's a true emergency and what's not. And you know who really is the beholder of that? It's the patient. It's what they define as a true emergency. And if someone thinks that the sniffles is a true emergency and they can't get care anywhere else, or they're the new mother and new father and they've got a baby that's got their first cold, but they don't know if that's something that's life-threatening or something that's just fine, they should get them evaluated.
Can we afford to take that attitude?
I think we must. And here's a great example, a modern-day example. Up in Washington, they're trying to rein in Medicaid spending. And they defined a list of 100 medical conditions which would not be reimbursed and patients should not go to the emergency room for. Those included things like diabetic coma, miscarriage, chest pain. You know, so when you look at the spectrum and say other people should define what a patient should go to the emergency room for, it's just wrought with hazard for the patient, medical hazard for the patient. So really, I think that, you know, while we have a broken system that people can't get into their primary care doctors sometimes as often as they want or just can't have access, we really do have to have that emergency department as a safety net and a place that people feel welcome to come.
Doctor?
I think, too, just to add a little bit more color to that situation, you know, healthcare is obviously the expense of healthcare is a huge concern in this country, as it should be, and reining it in should be a priority for us. But if you look at emergency care spending, how much it is of the total healthcare expenditure, it's only about 2-4% of all healthcare expenditure in this country. So although I think every component of healthcare could be more cost effective, when you look at where you're really going to rein cost in, I don't know if it's by limiting emergency care.
I read this figure that you just threw out there yesterday, and it actually surprised me because we've, over the last 10 years or so, have had a lot of conversations, mostly political conversations, about health care. And one of the things that you constantly hear politicians say is that people have got to stop going to the emergency room. It's the most expensive health care that we can possibly provide. That's why we need health insurance, universal coverage, if you're a proponent of that, because it will take people out of the emergency room and it'll be more cost effective. And you're saying that emergency medicine accounts for only 2-4% to a high of 7% of U.S. healthcare expenditures. And that does not sound high to me. So are the politicians lying?
High. It isn't high.
So are the politicians lying to us, or do they simply not understand the problem?
I'd like to believe in the good of all people, so I think that they probably just don't know the data and don't completely understand the problem. I don't think anyone's trying to lie. I think it is one of the biggest misconceptions in our field that we are expensive or that we are misutilizing resources.
And yet, emergency physicians provide, and this is a quote from one of your organizations, provide more charity care than any other specialty. The average emergency physician provides over $138,000 of charity care or bad debt annually. Your words. I'm curious. Which is it, charity or bad debt?
That's free care that's provided by emergency physicians. A study that was done when I was on the board of the American College of Emergency Physicians really brought this to light when we showed that somewhere between $138,000 and $144,000 of care is provided in this country by every practicing emergency physician.
Is that every year? Every year. So how many practicing emergency room physicians are there in the country?
There are about 40,000.
40,000 times 144,000 is a lot of money, isn't it?
Well, that's the amount of free care that's provided. And you're right, it is a lot of care. What has happened in the emergency department is we don't choose the patients who come to us. Patients come to us because they have a perceived need or they've called an ambulance and they've come to the department and we're there and we provide care, as was stated earlier, for everyone who shows up at the door. What policymakers have done to to make budget often is just to cut the amount of money that they pay us per visit. And often in most of our emergency departments, we are paid about 25 or 30% of what we charge. So people, I guess, often look at what's charged to them, and it sometimes seems high. But I think most people who run a business would have difficulty if they were collecting 28 or 25 cents of every dollar that they charge.
That's
the environment that we work in.
I just pulled out my phone and did the numbers. 40,000 physicians times $144,000 a year of charity care is $5,760,000,000 every year. That's a significant amount of health care expense, isn't it?
It is. But when you look at how many people come to the doors, that's, you know, one-third of the American population, if you want to put it in those numbers, one-third of the American population is seen in the emergency department every year. I think the most recent number is right around 137 million people. So that's one-third of the American population.
And some of them can pay.
Yep.
And some of them are charged, or their insurance pays for it,
exactly.
Correct? Not everybody comes in there and can't afford anything.
Exactly. And there are some, you know, a lot of the things is there are some outliers, too. There are people who have, you know, because of, you know, I think psychiatric problems or because of social issues, come to the emergency department time and time again. You know, our term for it is recidivism. And those people, I think, and you read about them sometimes in the paper, you know, John Smith runs up $3 million in emergency department costs or hospital costs per year.
Right.
And those people sometimes, those outliers, do drive a lot of that, of what goes into our bottom line of that number.
But are there people out there who could afford health insurance but choose not to because they can go to the emergency room and get free care?
I think anecdotally that's probably the minority of people, and I think we will see a big change with that now with everything that's going on in healthcare reform. We will see more people who are in fact insured, but to kind of touch on a point that you said before, giving them insurance and providing them coverage doesn't necessarily provide them access. And so although I think that insuring everybody will help with some of these numbers, help with, you know, decrease our amount of uncompensated care, it is going to be a big demand on our specialty to provide care and to be available to all of these people who are now insured but have no access to care anywhere else.
We have been told by proponents of universal coverage, or even what is now called, even Mr. Obama calls it this, Obamacare, that will be the panacea, that this will cut costs, that it will provide greater access to health care by people who heretofore have not been able to see a physician or afford procedures that they need, and that it will save lives and make people healthier, et cetera. One of your organizations says that having insurance actually increases the number of emergency department visits, and that seems diametrically opposed to what we've been told. How is that so?
So when you look at the numbers, it's actually the people who come to the emergency department the most are actually Medicaid patients. Insurance patients are kind of much lower down on that spectrum. But the one kind of testing pot that we have is Massachusetts. And when you look at what happened in Massachusetts once they insured their entire population, is emergency departments went up by 7%. And you can say, well, why is that? Everyone's got insurance. Well, it's not as simple as that, because when everyone has insurance, what do they try to do? Establish a primary care physician. Now, when you don't have enough primary care physicians, what do you do? And you can't get into that. So that's why many people have to go to the emergency department, even with insurance.
I want to come back to that, because that also contradicts the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta and what they say about insurance and emergency room visits. But we have to take a break. We'll come back with more in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bragg Financial Advisors, supporting Catawba Lands Conservancy's year-end giving campaign to help protect local farms, natural resources, wildlife habitat, and trails. Details at catawbalands.org. Well, last week's tragedy in Connecticut prompts new questions about how to keep students safe at school, what parents, administrators, and safety experts think should be done to improve security. That's the topic at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you've been to the emergency room. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Hello, I'm Roger Sorrow. The WFAE staff and I would like to thank the 520 listeners who called in during our one-day end-of-year campaign. Some became new members, others chose to renew or make an additional gift. If you did not have a chance to call, you can still make your end-of-year contribution at our secure website, WFAE.org. Thanks and happy holidays.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and sitting in our Spirit Square studio talking about emergency medicine, the youngest field of medicine, and some of the challenges they face and some of the myths we're going to bust today are Dr. Angela Fasaro, emergency room physician at Gaston Memorial, Dr. Don Stater, senior emergency medical resident at CMC, and Dr. John Moorhead joins us by phone from Portland, Oregon, where he is president of the American Board of Emergency Medicine. We were just talking about the impact of having health insurance and universal care or government-supplied care or the new health care law that will cause most of us, if not all of us, to have to buy some form of health insurance. And we're being told that that will lessen the cost of medical care because it will reduce the number of people who come to the emergency room, which is the most expensive form of medical care, we keep being told, although maybe it's not. And you're saying, Dr. Stater, that it actually, if Massachusetts is the touchstone, it actually increases the number of visits to the emergency room because there aren't enough primary care physicians to deal with having everybody being able to afford a visit to one. And that's going to be a national problem as we go forward. But the Centers for Disease Control says that uninsured adults were more likely than those with private health insurance or a public health plan to visit the emergency room due to having no other place to go. So who's right?
They both are. And when you look at it, you do say, yes, well, who comes to the emergency department? And if you look at it just from the numbers that we see, a large portion of those are people who don't have insurance or who have Medicaid and can't get access as well. If you look at it right now, the people who do have insurance are more likely to have a primary care physician to have some access. Mm-hmm. But there's some 30 to 40% of people in this country who don't have health insurance as it sits right now, which is why, you know, there was such a big push by the Obama administration to create a national health care plan, which will ensure all these thus far non-insured people. And you know, the
Michael, what's happened in the past, and we have a center here in Oregon who studies health policy and looks at the effects of health policy on our emergency medicine community. It previously was the practice in most states that if you cut your Medicaid budget, it wouldn't be denying benefits to everyone who was covered by Medicaid. It would be taking people on and off Medicaid and providing them insurance for a year, and then they would lose it. What we've learned is that when people lose their insurance, they don't go line up in the emergency department for care. They don't get care. And when they don't get care, they have conditions that don't get their needed ongoing care. And the patients that we really feel that we can help most by coordinating our care and by having universal access are those patients who require that coordinated ongoing care. And it is true that some of those patients, through better ongoing coordinated care, will have less medical crisis in their lives and will visit the emergency department for those reasons less frequently. And that's one area that people point to that will not, most importantly, will improve the care that's provided to patients, but should result in some cost savings. But I think we go beyond Massachusetts. I happen to grow up in Canada. So I know about a single, or it's not a single, it's actually every province has their own plan, but it's viewed as a single universal coverage area. And when I did my health policy program several years ago, one of the aspects that we studied in that program was the ED utilization. And we looked at England, and we looked at France, and we looked at Canada.
ED being emergency department, correct?
Emergency department,
okay.
That's correct.
Right. Go ahead.
And that's one of the things we've evolved. We're not a room anymore. We are a department, a full-functioning coordinated department. Mm-hmm. But when you look across countries, and several of those have universal insurance, the utilization of emergency departments by patients is almost the same in each of those countries. The reason people come to see us every day is varied. And so we expect that there will be a continuing need for patients to come to the emergency department. But we know that providing them insurance, and most importantly, providing them access, will improve their care and improve the population health. And that's really what we're participating in to improve our system.
This is a little off topic, but I just want to bring up the fact that almost every doctor that I've talked to in the course of doing this program over the years is an advocate of health insurance. And an advocate of almost all of them, single payer health insurance, but that never came up in the political debate. I just think that's interesting, that physicians are in favor of this. You brought up, I believe, Dr. Fassaro, that last year emergency departments saw over 130 million Americans, a third of the population. Maybe it was you, Dr. Stater. I can't remember, but that's a lot of people, and I'm wondering what that does to your ability to serve those people. I know that one of the issues that emergency departments around the country face is crowding and the inability to move patients from the emergency room into a bed because there are no beds available when they are needed, or that people have to sit in the waiting room for a long time because there just simply aren't enough people to handle the people that come through the door. Is it a problem? How big a problem is it?
I mean, I think as with anything, you have a limited number of space, a limited number of hours in the day, and we're limited. So obviously there will come a point where you hit your maximum capacity, and yes, it is an issue, and I think it will continue to be an issue as we have increased volume through the emergency department. But I think we have a great triage system that helps us to prioritize patients, so we know as soon as they walk through the door who is the sickest and who needs care most quickly.
So if you come in with a vague complaint of a stomach ache or a cough or a cold, you're not going to get treatment perhaps as quickly as somebody who comes in with a stroke.
Right, because some of those conditions are more time sensitive than others. We have seen, you know, with data in the past that the more you can do earlier on, the better outcomes for patients. So we know how to prioritize which ones we treat first. But I think you highlight an issue for us that, yes, we need more inpatient beds, we need more physicians, we need more of everything to handle the demands that we're seeing in our departments.
One of the other issues that emergency departments face include increasing violence in the emergency department and problems presented by patients with psychiatric issues. Well, I'm not sure who to ask this question of, but talk about that. Because that seems to be something that I would not want to go to work every day and face.
This is a particular passion of mine. Yes, the emergency department, when you compare it to other places to work, is very violent. When you look at, you know, all across employment places, you know, we healthcare sector has a large amount of violence when compared to other jobs. I think it's second only to police officers. We see more violence than just about any other job location. You know, if you talk to nurses or doctors, the overwhelming majority of them throughout their career have been threatened in some ways. Less of them have been physically attacked or stalked. And it is an element of the job that I think we probably need better training in, how to protect ourselves so that we can continue to.
Who threatens you? What kind of a person comes in and violently threatens the people they're coming to see to treat them?
Well, I think you have to consider that you're seeing people at the best and worst moments in their life, and that, you know, it is a very high pressure, very stressful situation that anyone really could find themselves in. And when pushed, people act sometimes not ideally and therefore end up lashing out at their providers.
So I think one of the things that we experience uniquely in the healthcare environment is people who have psychosis and who are not thinking rationally. And then we also experience a lot of the problems with drugs and alcohol that exist within our society.
Yeah, you see a lot of the underbelly. The emergency departments around the country see the underbelly of urban areas. And I'm told that from your experience in Charlotte, we have a huge cocaine problem.
For sure. And actually, you can meld both of these stories together very well. And, you know, just in the last year, we had a patient who came in who was very high on cocaine, extremely belligerent and extremely violent. This patient, you know, at first was calmed down, but then got it in his mind that he would not stay for a medical evaluation, even though he came in with chest pain. When one of the nurses tried to get him to restrain, he actually struck that nurse in the face with his fist and tried to run out of the emergency department. And a combination of security, myself and another emergency medicine resident all had to restrain this gentleman, despite threats, despite kicks, despite everything else. And that's really, across the nation, mm-hmm. not an uncommon circumstance.
If you watch TV news, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think part of the problem, too, is that we have embraced this as almost something that not should be, but is commonplace in the emergency department, that it's a chaotic, crazy environment. And so when these things happen, they're, one, underreported. So I think that our stats on how often violence is happening is probably even more than we think it is. But we
– within the ER.
We kind of turn a blind eye almost and just say, oh, well, it's part of my job. You know, but if you consider this kind of behavior in any other environment, if you were at the airport and someone got hit in the face, that would be a huge national scandal, and we wouldn't tolerate it. So I think – that's part of our problem, is that we don't have a no-tolerance policy in our work environment.
And how would you establish one? You still have to deal with the people who come in with medical problems.
You do, but I think there's appropriate repercussions still for – I mean, you would still treat them the same. Obviously, we want to treat everyone –
but there would be legal repercussions on the backside.
Yes.
And they're not now.
I don't think they're as strong as they should be.
Okay. What about
– Michael, I don't want your listeners to be afraid to come to the emergency department. We understand that these kinds of situations exist, and we staff up to protect both patients as well as staff. So it is an issue, but I think the whole issue of psychiatric patients, patients with substance abuse, is just a very visible area of the situation that you're describing, with people having a lack of ongoing care and arriving in a crisis situation to an emergency department. Those are just the kinds of patients who will benefit from having insurance, having ongoing care, and having the care that they need provided on an ongoing basis. We have participated in studies with the American Medical Association that has really looked at this across the country. And it's, again, it's a resource issue. We've taken patients from putting them in a hospital to treat them for psychiatric patients to better providing care in a community with outpatient resources. But as budgets have become tight and as people have cut back, those resources have been limited, and those patients don't have the kind of ongoing care that they require. And again, they show up in a crisis situation. We're happy to provide that care, but we know that patients can be provided better ongoing care. So it's just a very visible example of exactly the situation we've been talking about that exists within the whole healthcare system. Nowhere do I see it more prevalent with a young child who has an acute psychiatric need and may need to be admitted to the hospital, but may sit in our emergency department for 4 or 5 days because there are no inpatient beds available.
Four or five days? Sitting in the waiting room?
Not in the waiting room, in a treatment room.
Treatment room.
But that's not where these patients should be treated. And we need to recognize the resources needed to provide patients the care they need in the setting that's going to be most productive.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk a little bit about this, because one of the reasons that you're on here to talk about the specialty of emergency medicine is that you folks are embarking on a history collection and dissemination project here, so to speak. Several of the board members of the Emergency Medicine Residents Association work at Carolina's Medical Center, and you've embarked on telling the story of your field of medicine by producing a documentary. For whom is that intended?
Well, the documentary itself is really a unique set of circumstances. Let me speak a little bit about the background, and then I'll give you exactly who it's meant for. One of the things that we have, being one of the youngest specialties in the House of Medicine, is a lot of people who are trailblazers in medicine and people who founded our field are still alive and able to share that narrative of what it was like in the early days and what it was like to bring about this tremendous change to improve patient care. One thing that's sadly been happening, of course, as people reach their 70s and their 80s, is that some of them begin to pass away. And one of those real heroes was actually a hero here in Charlotte, who was the chair of our emergency department, who is Dr. John Marks. And Dr. Marks, retired. And when he had his retirement party, a lot of people got together and talked about what exactly he meant to the field. And this is something that Angela and I both said, wow, this needs to be recorded. This story needs to be shared with everyone who's going to be an emergency physician, and with the public, I think, also, because the public has a lot of misconceptions about what emergency care means. Mm-hmm. So we went on this. We've now embarked on this thing, which we call the EMRA Legacy Initiative. And we've flown around the country recording some of the original founders of our field and really recording. They're, first of all, just extraordinary people with extraordinary stories and extraordinary passion for humanity. And when you record them, they are inspirational in a lot of the things that they've done. And they're really, remind us why we became physicians and why our field is of such importance. But that's basically what this project is. And at the end product is going to be a documentary that's going to be 1 hour in length. That's going to show the evolution of emergency medicine. And it's meant for not only emergency physicians, but also for the public. Because right now, like you said, the public has a pretty big fascination with emergency medicine. The show ER, of course, comes to mind. Before that, the show Emergency back in the 70s. And it's about time that emergency physicians told it through their own eyes and told people exactly what goes on.
I have a minute left. I'm just curious where you see this specialty, your specialty, heading, and how you see it being affected by the emergence of the National Healthcare Situation, the Act.
Can I just give one, before we answer that question, I just want to give the website to any of the listeners who wants to go to it. It's 247365doc.com. That's 247365doc.com. And please visit.
And those are all numbers. I have 30 seconds. So where do you think this is heading, and how will you be impacted by the national healthcare law?
I think we are, as we've previously mentioned, the gateway to the hospital. And I think because of that, we see policy changes on the front lines. I'd actually like to think that we are going to be affecting the policy as we go forward, not that we will be affected by it.
And how would you like to see people use emergency rooms?
I think, as we said, everybody has a different definition to emergency, and we feel proud every day that it's a privilege to serve them in the setting of those worst and best moments of their life. So I'd like them to come whenever they feel they have an emergency.
You get the last word. Dr. Angela Fusaro, emergency room physician at Gaston Memorial. Dr. Don Stater, also in our studio, senior emergency medical resident at CMC. And joining us by phone from Portland, Oregon, Dr. John Moorhead, president of the American Board of Emergency Medicine. Thank you all three for the hour. Hope to never see you outside of this kind of a setting again.
Thank you.